Open the Senate Committee on Education and General Government. I'm going to start off with an informational hearing. A report on Oregon pre-kindergarten funding and early Head Start. We have some testimony, invited testimony, and otherwise, if you haven't signed up and you would like to testify on this. But if we could start with Dick Alexander and Swati Darkar. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here. Thank you, Chair Haas and committee members, for giving us the opportunity to come down and kind of bring you up to speed on what's taking place from our perspective with Oregon Pre-K in the recent past. You probably all recall, or certainly most of you do, and have served when it occurred, but the legislature in past years made a commitment to fully fund a Head Start in Oregon. And everyone's worked diligently to try to make that happen. There have been constraints. And we did make considerable progress in the last session thanks to decisions that the legislature and the governor made. And they put $39 million in new money into OPK. For that, where all of us that have been working and trying to make that happen are very grateful. What occurred and how that money's been used, there are about 3,000 kids that are in the program today that were not in the program before. The waiting list has been reduced some. It's been influenced upward somewhat by the economy. But we're now serving about 12,600 kids in OPK Head Start in the state of Oregon. There probably is something like 3,400 kids that are still eligible and would avail themselves of the program if the money were available. So there's room to grow. What we did after the last session and after the $39 million was granted and used, the Children's Institute, who are here with me today, Swati Adhokar to my left, who is the executive director of the Children's Institute in Portland, and Dr. David Mandel, who is the chief research person in the Children's Institute. They, with ODE's blessings, contacted the providers of services for Head Start in Oregon, the franchise holders, and tried to determine what would be the capacity for further expansion if money were available to do it, rather than just come out and say there's X number of kids and let's go and get the money for them. We tried to determine what we could handle if we had the money, and came down to about 1,400 kids is the capacity of the present providers to expand. That's about a $13 million cost in expansion, roughly. It was also determined, though, if you did expand by 1,400 kids, you used up all the capacity that existed. How do you grow from that point? And one thing you would need to consider is to have enough money available to go out and begin to recruit and train and put on other providers so that you could achieve that goal long term of serving all the kids that were eligible living in poverty in Oregon. And so, and the request also covered about 700 or 800 more kids that it was assumed could be added as a result of expanding to new providers over the course of the biennium. It brought that number up closer to 20-something million. Our original request to the governor was that he put into his budget about 24.2 million, which would cover the 1,400 kids, about 700 to 800 additional kids, so you'd have some expansion momentum going forward. But you can't go out and encourage people to become providers and not have the ability to say when you meet those standards and you hire the people, we can give you students. Anyway, that was the number that we asked for, with about a 10% set aside for early Head Start, and that was new. What a token investment in early Head Start would establish Oregon as a state that has a 0-5 partnership with the federal government for the whole 0-5 continuum. Right now we have a good partnership working on Head Start, but it would add that other dimension of early Head Start. And I think one thing that I would ask the committee to consider, and others that we'll talk with, is that With the current administration, it's very likely that over time, over the years, we'll see more money flow into Head Start. I believe that probably is true. And I just pray that that doesn't keep us from doing the right thing in the state of Oregon. But anyway, I think that if we had that continuum established, the 0-5 continuum with a modest commitment from Oregon for early Head Start, we would probably have a perception at the federal level of a state that had its act pretty well together and might have more favorable standing in terms of getting money into early Head Start in Oregon, which can be very, very helpful. Anyway, so that's something to be considered. But where we are now is, you know, I guess I feel almost an obligation to do a quick 30-second or 1-minute commercial. I think that there's no doubt in my mind, after my work on the Crime Commission and all that I've been involved with from the business perspective, et cetera, that early childhood education is probably the single best investment that you can make along the education continuum. And it doesn't mean a lot that I believe that, but it should mean something that almost every other person on the planet that really studies this says that, and they do. The best economists that you can talk to will tell you that that's the greatest return on the buck, is at those early ages. And I've also grown to believe, based on the opinion of others whose I respect, that once you miss that opportunity with these kids, you don't get it all back later. It's not something you can recover in the fourth grade, the fifth grade, the sixth grade. It is, in many parts, it's past. And that you've missed your chance to capture it. And we all know that as these children that we talk about today become adults, and we know that they will be adults a lot more years than their children, when we fail to address this need at this point, and I might interject at this point that I'm a guy that years ago believed that this was purely the parent's responsibility. Don't bother me with it. I did. A very hard-nosed, conservative approach that I believed, and I believed I was right. Well, I was wrong, because when the parents can't or do not do something about it, we pay an enormous cost as those children grow up and become adults. And as they get into trouble with law enforcement, as they drop out of school, as they require special education, and as they fall into the social safety net as they become adults, and they grow old and they die, and they leave oftentimes children that follow in the same pattern. Not all the time, and not all of them, but too often that's what happens. And it's a lot cheaper to invest a little bit of money up front right now and cause a lot of that not to occur. It's also a workforce quality issue. There's a lot of things that it touches. But the anyway, that's where we pretty much are, and that's what I believe, and I'm sharing with you what I've just picked up from other sources and spending several years as a business person that became aware, kind of went through a change of heart that I share with you today. But I think what I'd like to do, if I could, is ask Swati Adarkar, the executive director of the Jones Institute, to share with you a little bit of her comments about early Head Start and the benefits of it, because it's a little bit new to all of us. We're only serving about 3% of the kids that are eligible for it. But the kids in the lowest income families that have the most factors working against them in their lives are the ones that we're talking about and she's going to talk about.
Thank you for inviting us here today. As Dick mentioned, we know that high-quality early education is the most effective strategy to close the achievement gap. And the window to close that achievement gap is birth to five. And we've been making tremendous progress, thanks to the legislative leadership of you and your colleagues and the governor in making the recent expansion to OPK. But we also know that we must start earlier. Gaps in language proficiency can now be detected as early as 18 months. And the neuroscience has advanced, so we know that those first 3 years are absolutely critical in terms of brain development. And the brain development that happens in those first few years sets the architecture for later cognitive development. And so if we don't get it right in the beginning, in those first 3 years, catching up is very costly and far more difficult. Head Start directors know that early Head Start is greatly needed because every day they have children coming to their program with behavioral challenges and developmental delays that those teachers know could have been addressed before they got to their doorstep. And as Dick mentioned, we have an abundance of research, long-term studies such as the Abbasidarian study, which provided early childhood education for at-risk children starting at birth and followed these children into adulthood. And we know the incredible return on investment from starting early, providing programs that are intensive over time. And the results of the Abbasidarian study, those children in their adult years, we learned, had reduced special education placement, higher reading and math ability into adulthood, and much higher college enrollment, 157% greater. These are very significant results. In more current research, the Early Head Start program has had a rigorous national evaluation, and we know that all the important antecedents to school success are showing up in this study. Enhanced cognitive development, decreased aggressive behavior, parents that are more supportive and are brought into supporting their children's learning very early on. The Early Head Start program is very flexible, and I think sometimes it's hard to think about what would early education be for an infant. There are home-based programs. You have home visitors going, so it's flexible. There's a home-based model as well as a center-based model. The most effective results combine both, where in the very youngest ages, there's a home visitor going to a home setting. As the child gets more mobile, you're transitioning to a center-based setting. And there are just incredible results. Right now in Oregon, we have six federally funded Early Head Start program and one program funded by the Portland Children's Investment Fund, so a total of seven programs. But as Dick mentioned, we are serving a very small fraction percentage of these children, probably less than 3% at this point.
Swati, can I just interrupt just
sure.
a second? First, we need you to identify yourself for the record.
Sure.
But just to let the committee know, we're talking about the Head Start program and the early.
Right. The piece that I've been focusing
and
on.
Some of this you're doing on the sidelines with the budget committees, right? So
yes.
And so you're going to, and for us, from a policy perspective, is what you're bringing to us. Just
we're sharing how to build upon the significant advances we've been making in the preschool arena and bringing forward the research as to why we must build on the companion piece that supports birth to three for at-risk children.
Okay.
I'm Swati Adarkar, the Executive Director of the Children's Institute. Pleasure to be with you. And I just want to mention this issue of Oregon's positioning nationally around early education. As Dick mentioned, the current president and his administration, new education secretary, has a strong emphasis on early education. And Oregon is getting a lot of attention because of our Oregon pre-K model following the Head Start standards. And David can tell you as well, our research director, we go to meetings and people ask us all the time how their states can follow that path. And so what we've put in place is this federal-state partnership that provides a seamless early education continuum on the preschool piece. And now we have an opportunity, even with a modest first-time investment in state dollars with Early Head Start, of creating a federal-state partnership that would position the state to have an early learning system focused on the most at-risk children, birth to five, when we know where we know the research supports investing in closing the achievement gap. So I think with a modest investment in Early Head Start, we position the state to be poised for federal dollars down the road. So I think that's important to put on the table as well.
Well, thank you both for your testimony, Mr. Alexander, for chairing this this group, Ready for School. If you want to stand by, I do have Representative Van Orman. If you'd like to testify now, since you're here, and I know you've got other duties.
Can I bring Kilcorey with me, Mr. Chairman?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Haas and members of the committee. I am Suzanne Van Orman. I am representative of House District 52, which is Hood River County, East Multnomah County, and East Clackamas County. And I'm here today as the historian, as you can imagine, of Head Start in Oregon and as a former Head Start director in the Mid-Columbia region for 22 years. When I started, we were very small, and in 1987, Senator Frank Roberts came to the Oregon Head Start people, and we participated in the writing of the legislation that created the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program. And in that legislation, we as Oregon directors insisted that we follow the federal performance standards and that we did, in fact, emphasize parent involvement. And so I have with me Corey, who will give you the perspective of a parent, but I can tell you today about the operation of a Head Start program. In our particular program, we started out with 95, and when I left in 2006, we were up to 483. Our particular program, because we had three counties in Washington, excuse me, in Oregon and two counties in Washington, we had the Oregon pre-kindergarten dollars, we had the Washington State Early Childhood Education Assistance Program dollars called ECAP, and then we also had about 95 early Head Start children, which we did infant toddler child care, where these children were in child care, and then we also did the home visit, as was reported to you earlier. So we've got a lot of experience in doing both of those, and one of the most interesting pieces for early Head Start is the child care piece. And we were using Head Start dollars as well as child care dollars to make the program go, because the infant toddler ratio is an expensive model, because you have to have 4 to 1. And in some cases, some days, it seemed like it was 2 to 1 in order to meet the state standards in child care regulations. So we used employment-related daycare dollars to help us with that program. I am definitely, it was the career of my life. I loved every moment of it. I can tell you from my experience what a difference it makes in the lives of children, especially when I saw the babies, because I was not, I had been a survivor of the 1975 child care wars down here. So child care is a very, very difficult business. And so I was reluctant. But when I saw the difference it made in the babies, I couldn't help but support the program. I'm also here to tell you that it makes a difference for families and parents, because we support the parents. And Oregon was one of the leaders in a combination model, which is kids in school 3 days a week in some programs, and then family home visits. So tying those two pieces together to improve the lives of children and family was very essential. So I'm here if you have any questions. I'm also available anytime. And I would like to turn it over to Corey, who can relate to you her experience as a parent.
Representative, thank you for your testimony. And we were lucky to have someone with your knowledge base on this issue in this legislative session. So
thank you.
Corey, if you want to just start off with your name and tell us your story about how this helped and why it was important, and go from there.
Okay. First of all, my name is Corey Bruin. And as she said, you know, I've been a parent with Head Start for quite a while. excuse me, starting back about 6 years ago, I put my first child through Head Start. Excuse me. And when I started, I was very skeptical. I didn't really know much about the program. I had been basically referred to Head Start through an early intervention, William and ESD. And they had told me about Head Start and said that, thank you very much, that I qualified more for that and I should look into that. When I did, like I said, I was very skeptical. I didn't know what kind of program it was. I had heard of it as a program basically for, program that had long been known in my mind and to people I know as a program for people with issues and families with issues. And, you know, the word issues didn't necessarily settle well in my mind. And, you know, I figured, and I never had my kids away from me. So when I put my son in the program, I decided that if I was going to have him in the program, I would be involved in every way possible. I started out at my site being the president for my parent committee. From there, I went on to policy council, where I became eventually the chairperson for policy council. From there, I went on to be an OHSA rep, which is basically going to state meetings and stuff and finding out what they're doing for Head Start around the state. Also, I served on the board of directors for our agency. And I went from being a very shy person, a very skeptical person, to someone who truly believes in Head Start. And, like, if I could go on and on forever, I totally could, you know, but...
Let me ask you, how many children?
I have 4 children now. I have had 3 of those children go through Head Start. And I currently have my last child in Head Start right now.
What area are you from?
I'm from here in Salem.
Okay.
Yes, I'm from the Community Action Head Start here in Salem. And
well, I was going to ask you what you do, but if you have 4 kids, I think that pretty much tells me.
Well, actually, that's part of what I'm here to share is, like I said, about 5 years ago, I started as a parent. I currently now work for Head Start. So I've kind of come full circle in the process of being a parent, not necessarily believing in the program, not knowing a lot about the program, learning a lot about the program and all of the programs and all of the services that it actually offers to families and children. And it's become a huge part of my life, and I'm very proud to be part of the Head Start team. And just to go back on something that Dick said earlier, which I totally believe people really need to think about, is that I believe an ounce of prevention is worth a lifetime of intervention. And it is true. If we can prepare my children and, you know, these children that are here in Head Start and that are growing up to be old enough to apply for Head Start now, so that they're ready to learn in school, it's going to put them on the foundation to success and their family's success, future success.
I would like to follow up on what she has said about her becoming employed by Head Start. Head Start came out of the war on poverty, as some of you may know, and part of the Head Start experience was eventually to hire parents, if we could. And it has been a very successful model, and because of that model, Head Start is also invested in training. So that we have put a lot of parents through the workforce in Head Start. I also needed to mention that Head Start is comprehensive. It's about education. It's about the health care of the child. It's about the mental health services. It's about nutrition. It's about all of those things. And when she referred to policy council, one of my jobs was to report to 2 boards, my parent policy council, which had the authority to hire and fire staff and to make decisions about what the program looked like and decisions about the budget. And then we had a board of directors. So it's a complex program, and as it has been said, if you've seen one Head Start, you have seen one Head Start. We reflect our communities. So if there are any other questions?
Questions? Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Mandel, I know you're up here. I didn't want to chase you off. If you had some testimony, if you were just standing by.
Dr. Mandel was joining us today so he could answer any questions from the panel regarding the research that he did. But we're open for questions later, but we would refer to the testimony of our very good partner, Mike Graham, Invest in Kids.
Okay.
And we'll answer any questions.
Okay. That feedback you may hear, or that you do hear, may be from somebody's cell phone. So the warning is out. If you can, turn them off. I know it's not me this time because I forgot mine.
We turned ours off.
Oh, Senator Bonamici. Okay.
I turned mine off, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Senator Haas. Thank you for the invitation for being here this afternoon, and thank you for the other senators. First of all, my name is Martha Brooks, and I'm the state director of Fight Crime, Invest in Kids. I have with me today one of my members, who is the Honorable Walt Beglau, who's the district attorney for Marion County. And I'm going to start off, give you just a little brief overview of what Fight Crime Invest in Kids is, and then Mr. Beglau is going to do the, as I call it, the heavy hauling and let you tell him why they're involved in this organization and why Head Start and Early Head Start are important in their efforts to fight crime. We are a national organization made up of over 5,000 police chiefs, sheriffs, prosecutors from across the United States with 160 members here in Oregon. Most of Oregon's police chiefs, prosecutors, and sheriffs are members of Fight Crime Invest in Kids. They are members of Fight Crime Invest in Kids because they know that programs, they believe in programs and investments in programs such as Head Start, Early Head Start, Healthy Start, Relief Nurseries, and other high-quality early education programs are proven to give kids the right start in life and will cut crime. These important and well-respected members of our communities know firsthand about crime and can also tell you firsthand why prevention is in the form of these programs is one of the best solutions. Without any further delay, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Mr. Beglau.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Walt Beglau. I'm the Marion County District Attorney, and I want to thank you for this opportunity to join you today. And it's a pleasure to join my colleagues with Fight Crime, Invest in Kids, the Children's Institute, Ready for School. I have to say, together, we are clearly on the same page when it comes to investments in early childhood prevention and development programs like Head Start, 3-4-5, Early Head Start, before that. Our relief nurseries here in Salem, we have the family building blocks. And, of course, Healthy Start, which is families and babies and at home. If we've come to grips with anything in public safety over the last couple years, it's been the fragility of the developing brain 0-5. And it's taken some heavy hitters like Dr. Ross Thompson at UC Davis and other colleagues, other experts, to help us understand that the neurologic pathways that the healthy brain development 0-5 are imperative gateways to learning and very predictive of future behavior. And I don't know why, really, it takes neuroscientists to tell us this, because our experience with little babies, you want to pick them up and you want to cuddle them. Our babies, we should be kneeling down and engaging our toddlers. That's the experience that all children should have. But for years in public safety, I'll have to tell you, and I have a few numbers here that still knock me off my chair when I speak to them, but for years in public safety, we've seen the inevitable outcome of families that have failed to kneel down. In Marion County alone, since January 1st of 2005, over 3,000 vulnerable children have been rescued and taken into protective care, many of which will grow up to replicate the intergenerational cycle of neglect, addiction, despair, and inevitably, criminality. And I see that every single day. You spend 10 minutes in our juvenile department with the 10 on Tuesday, the mothers and their children, and you will get a picture of the grim experience that these families are have had and will continue to have. The studies have supported this compelling link about a child's resistance to criminal behavior in early childhood and quality programs like Early Head Start. I have read all of the research that they have provided to me. I have seen these children. And as we know, kids from 0-5, preparing them to learn during that particular time frame boosts graduation rates. One study at 44%. And emerging data, Mr. Alexander spoke to this, emerging data from economists indicates that boosting graduation, high school graduation rates, would reduce murder and assault of behavior exponentially. I call Healthy Start and Head Start, these programs, an inoculation against crime. That's the best phrase I can come up with. Perhaps the best evidence, and I've spent a little time there, from a policy perspective, is to actually spend a few minutes in a Head Start. These are truly vibrant learning centers. The kids are like sponges. They're wide-eyed. And I've noticed the staff just swoop in on those issues of literacy, health, nutrition, the social and emotional development benchmarks that are critical to that next step into kindergarten and beyond into high school. And just a commitment to these kids is crucial. Let me end by saying why, or express to you, if I may, why this means so much to me as district attorney. And I've written to this before, but let me say this. When a young man commits a violent assault or a murder, it's simply too late. A victim's family is devastated by that, and they deserve justice. The family and friends mourn. The community is injured permanently by that particular crime. And my responsibility as DA and in law enforcement at that point is public safety, and that will mean, more often than not, prison. Programs like Head Start provide a measurable preventative shift from the outcomes, the tragic outcomes of criminal behavior. And it is so worthy to be making an investment from a law enforcement perspective on those little ones, 0 to 5. So again, thank you. Thank you for having me here today to speak from our end at the law enforcement piece. Thank you.
Well, we very much appreciate your passion for this issue, Mr. Goodwill and Ms. Brooks. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have what may be more of a comment, but as I've said before, I could make it a question if necessary. But thank you so much for especially bringing this particular aspect into the mix when we're considering these issues. And I noticed in looking at your written testimony, asking for the additional $6 million for pre-K Head Start and $1 million for early Head Start. And you may have heard we're in tough economic times, and that's the topic of practically every day discussion here. And I appreciate the importance of this issue, and especially from where your perspective is, I'm sure that you don't want us to cut public safety, and we certainly don't want to cut Health and Human Services. So, and of course, we don't want to cut K-12 because that is connected to all of this. So what I'm asking is for everybody who's here giving your voices on this issue to also give your voices when we start considering revenue measures to change our tax structure or to find additional revenue so that we're able to fund programs like early education and pre-K without cutting public safety and K-12 and human services. So I just ask everyone to keep that in mind as we go forth in the process, because I think certainly with I can't speak for all my committee members, but I'd be the first one in line to say, yes, I'd love to give you everything you ask for, because you've convinced me of the value of the program. But
thank you, Senator. We know it's a tough economic time, and that we're all going to have to face some cutbacks or some suffering at some point, even in our own personal budgets. We do know that at times like these, and you're well aware of it, that these are not the times to cut some of those services. And we understand, and we'll be there with you if that's what it takes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Well, thanks to all of you for bringing us up to speed on this issue. I know you're meeting with the Ways and Means people, and I don't think there's anyone who disagrees with the notion that it's better to invest on the early side of life than to spend on the later side of life, especially when we're spending on the services you're more familiar with in the corrections area.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Close the informational hearing, and I would like to open up a public hearing on SB 44. And open up a work session on SB 44. Before we start, colleagues, this is the what we affectionately call the technical fix to the kindergarten bill, extending what we did in February 2008. And you'll notice some amendments in your packets that seek to try to do more than that, but yet not commit to a financial obligation in the out years that that we don't know that we can meet. So I think I've met with most of you on this, and I talked to you. There's no pre-wired deal here. I do want to just, you know, sort of get the invite everyone to speak freely about these amendments or new amendments that we can add to this that pushes the ball forward, that goes beyond the minimum that we're really required to do. So I know we have some invited testimony. Before we get to those of you who are going to testify, Dana, if you could just sort of go over the summary of the amendments.
The amendments. The dash ones we had before us when we had this bill before us last time, and it also extends what the status quo through 2012, and then starting for the school year 2013 would allow schools to request funding for full offering supplemental or full day kindergarten. The dash twos carry forward the status quo, as it were, and allow districts to request funding for offering supplemental kindergarten starting in 2012. It also would establish a committee that would provide technical expertise on certain matters, particularly like capital needs and that sort of thing. And the Department of Education would be charged with staffing that. The dash threes extend the status quo through 2014-2015, although it provides for essentially kind of stepped up funding, a permissible tuition coinciding with stepped up state funding. And this is the idea that Mr. Ozzie Rose had provided in testimony at our last hearing. So that's kind of a summary, Senator, Mr. Chair.
Comments or questions before we take some witnesses? Senator Morris?
Which dash amendments are you wanting to focus on, Mr. Chair?
Well, I think the ones and twos, unless I got those out of order.
No, that's what. But I have, Mr. Chair, I have a question on the ones, section 7, page 6 and 7, which is dealing with is that dealing with the small school formula? Why is that piece in
it's
there?
It's the weighting of the small schools.
And my question there was, I know there was a work group dealing with the small school formula. Is this meshing with that work, or is this just making an adjustment?
It is making the necessary adjustment in proportion to that weight. And we can get Steve Myers up here to explain that.
I guess I'm wondering if we're setting ourselves up for some conflict amendments at some point in time. If, and I don't know. It's just a question. If there's other legislation in the building dealing with the small school formula, how does this mesh with that? And
I can just offer, Senator Cruz, and I don't know the answer to that question, but I can tell you that the language that you're seeing in ORS 327077 is not in the twos or threes.
Right.
So that's just the lay of the land. But I can't speak to specific other conflicting legislation that may be out there. I'm happy to contact LRO if we want to get some clarity on that today.
I think what we're looking for is something that says, here's a date we'd like to start at, and in the meantime, here's a study group or an implementation group to say, here's what we need to do in order to fund it and have the room to do it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I understand your intent, but this section kind of threw me a little bit.
It threw me. Whenever you get into the formula, especially with the small schools component, it's difficult.
Dash ones, yeah. As to. I mean, Mr. Chair, it's just an unknown at this point in time. You know, I mean, we can pass something, and then something else can pass, and then we mm-hmm. have to deal with conflict amendments. And
I've had that happen twice.
Well, I've had it happen more than once. But I don't know. I mean, I knew that there was work being done on the small school formula. So based on that, I'm assuming there's legislation somewhere dealing with that. And we don't know whether this impacts that or if we're setting up something here that's going to be at odds. And I just don't know.
Well, there actually is a policy question as to whether you have that weighting proportional on kindergarten for small schools. The twos and threes don't.
I understand that.
Okay.
I understand that.
So we're all looking at big picture here. Senator Morris, did you have comments on this?
No, I didn't. I just was wanting to know which amendment that you were wanting to focus on.
Well, I think they're all in play here.
Okay.
And they're all vulnerable to change, obviously. And Peter Tarzian is here from one of the small schools. Not that we want to pull you into that sea hunt, but...
I probably could shed a little light on it, I think, although I was rushing through trying to see. I hadn't seen the Dash 1 amendments. Mr. Chair, Senator Haas and Senators, good afternoon. My name is Peter Tarzian. I'm Superintendent of Schools of Falls City School District. I'm also the Legislative Chair for the Oregon Small Schools Association. If I could just briefly address Senator Cruz's question about the formula. Looking at the Dash 1 amendments, the Small School Association is working on a change to the formula, but it does not really address the area that this does. What it does is it establishes, it raises the floor for small high school funding.
Right.
Which technically I don't think that they would be in conflict. At least that's my quick read.
Okay.
I was here today really to give you the small school perspective on all-day kindergarten. We're extending kindergarten through the afternoon hours of the operation of small elementary schools and rural elementary schools. What I thought I would do, I've given you my prepared testimony, so I thought what I would do would be just to make a few additional comments and then open it up for questions.
We appreciate that very much.
So where I will start is, and just to give you a little background on my particular small elementary school, I have approximately 92 students. I have approximately 7 or 8 kindergartners on any given day. The total enrollment of my school district is right now 158. And I am considered to be very small in the reference small school study that was referenced a bit ago. To the concept of small schools and all day kindergartens, research tends to support the idea that if education has children for a longer period of time, there is some benefit, at least in the first developmental years in elementary school. The ability of research to continue to support that concept beyond about the fourth grade tends to kind of fall off because there's just too many other variables. And that's probably true for first grade as well. And, you know, you might recall that actually Oregon doesn't compel students to attend kindergarten or the first grade, but rather at age 7 they're compelled to attend school. And so as a policy issue, all-day kindergarten, half-day kindergarten, preschool is still all a part of the ongoing research that occurs in education. With that said, for small schools in particular, all-day kindergarten solves some very specific problems for parents in our communities and for the schools themselves. And two big ones are related to staffing of half-day kindergartens. We're always scrambling to try and find a teacher who is qualified to teach kindergarten, but then we don't particularly have a position for them in the afternoon. And so it's a matter of always looking for the best fit of a teacher, and that teacher has to have other endorsements. And so that's a big challenge. It's a fairly big challenge in my school district, but when you get across the mountains to the other side, it becomes very large. And so the ability to retain those highly qualified teachers is problematic. Then the other issue is for the families themselves. Half-day kindergarten, especially in rural communities, most, I would say, of our parents are working parents, where you find two people, you know, trying to make ends meet. They're then, therefore, challenged with daycare, and even though I would not characterize or want to characterize all-day kindergarten as extended daycare, in fact, the ability to fully fund all-day kindergarten is highly prized for rural small communities everywhere in the state. Out of your 198 school districts, about 125 fit this category. They don't represent a lot of students, probably about 7 to 10% of your student population district-wise, but they're spread all over the state, and it's a very important issue for child security and for child development. And so all-day kindergarten holds the potential to be able to support continuity for children's education as well as their well-being. I guess I would only like to close, of course, with I think what's the obvious, and everyone is concerned about, oh my goodness, another mandate. How are we going to fund it? Something's going to be taken away to support all-day kindergarten, regardless of whether or not it happens in 2012 or 2014 or so forth. From my perspective as a licensed school superintendent and educational leader in my community, however, I think it's an important step for the legislature to take on the issue of, is all-day education at the kindergarten level good public policy, good educational policy? And so I would encourage you to definitely require, if you were to use the Dash 2 amendments, to make that a key factor and charge for the committee, the study committee that you propose to establish. And that's what I have to say today.
Well, thank you for that. What about space at your school, or maybe you can speak to
well, school? Rural school perspective, Senator Haas and senators, rural school perspective there is many of, if not most, rural schools are in conditions of declining enrollment. And so, and that's also true for my school. So,
You have one class.
I have one classroom. That's
so going an extra 2.5 hours.
That's correct. However, you get into the larger school districts. So my spouse and I had quite a discussion last night about this issue. And it does create a challenge in the larger school districts. There's also a concern in the larger school districts where if you implement even a time frame where you have a time certain that you will establish all-day kindergarten, that districts politically, you know, will be forced into the position of a lot of pressure by primary parents to establish district-wide all-day kindergarten, and that will then be at the expense of other programs. And so that's why I believe that there's quite a lot of testimony, I'm sure you'll hear, about making sure that this is on top of fully funding our educational program in the state, regardless of where those that education is delivered.
Questions?
Would you just clarify for me, are the 8 to 12 students that you generally have, is that half-time or is that full-time kindergarten that you offer at Falls?
Those are kindergarten students, and they are half-time. They arrive in the morning and leave after lunch at 12 o'clock. In Fall City, we do bus them. Busing isn't required, but we have no sidewalks in Fall City, so we make sure that we send them home.
Okay. So full day would presumably take care of that extra trip if you didn't have to do that midday bus service?
It would. For us. I can't speak for the 197, though.
Other questions?
Mr. Harris, Chair.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. Peter, on the Dash 2 Amendment, Section 5, how would the small schools react to the mandate? The school district must offer half-day kindergarten in one or more schools in the district and may offer supplemental kindergarten in one or more schools. Now, you already offer the half day. Are you the exception, or are you the rule? We already do.
We're already required to offer half day kindergarten.
Right. This is bold type. Why would it be?
Yeah. Is that? I think that is the language necessary for the fix.
Mr. Chair, it's. Right, it's really clarifying language to have the status quo not be temporary. But that is the status quo. The language itself reflects the status quo.
It's written as though it's new.
In that statute, it is.
Okay.
That's basically just to extend the sunset.
Yes. Thank you, Senator Cruz, for putting that so much better than I was.
Okay. Senators, thank you very much.
We appreciate your help. Bethann Darby, Ozzie Rose, Chuck Bennett, Tricia Smith.
Oh my God, the four horsemen. All at once.
Making friends in the hallway.
Different
stuff.
Do you
need
one of them?
No.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Bethann Darby, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Education Association. And we are here to advocate for our support for full-day kindergarten for every five-year-old child and treating full-time kindergarten as the same as other full-time students in the state funding formula. We do believe that all programs must be fully funded, and that this is a really difficult time to do that. We definitely want to move the ball forward. We feel like this conversation keeps happening again and again, and we want to make sure that there is some real progress made and that we have a plan in place to accomplish that. With that in mind, we're suggesting a full-day kindergarten implementation plan legislative committee, and having this committee really take a hard look at what will it cost, what are the capacity issues in various school districts, taking a look at what it would cost to ensure that all kindergartners receive a full weight for every school district so that all school districts can be winners, taking a look at the cost of whether it's best to, whether we can afford to implement all at once or whether we need to approach it in a phased-in model similar to what Dr. Rose has proposed on other days here. And then we suggest that we set a target date of 2012-13 school year, having the committee report into the 2011 legislature, and the 2011 legislature would be in charge of changing the formula to fit with the plan that they've created. And we would support that, and we pledge ourselves to work hard at raising the revenue sufficient to fund full-day kindergarten for every five-year-old child.
Okay. Questions? Tricia?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I'm here speaking also in support of full-day kindergarten for all five-year-olds and the funding to get there. And we agree with Oregon Education Association and others that this is an issue that we seem to be spinning
on rather than actually making some progress. And we think that it's time to make some progress where that's possible, and we support OEA's suggestion that you establish an interim legislative committee that is responsible for developing a full-day kindergarten implementation plan. We think part of the reason that you've been unable to move forward on this issue is that you have not had the information that you needed to do that. In terms of what that impact would be in school districts. And this committee would allow you the opportunity to make an informed decision. So you would know which districts need to do capital projects, which districts have the ability to implement now. All those kinds of questions could be answered in this interim committee, and you could then in 2011 come back in and have the information and data that you need to pass a plan that will actually work in the districts. And we are supportive of that, and we pledge to you that we will work with you during the interim and in the next session to make that happen.
Thank you, Bill. Ms. Rose?
I'm going to change places with Chuck here.
Okay.
I'll just sit right here. I promise I won't go far.
Chuck, on the other hand,
you're ready. Just trying to cue everybody up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ozzie Rose. I represent the school districts in Washington County at the present time. I've had some involvement in this question for a while. Argued the other side of it at times. I told you that last time. But the Dash 3 amendments, by the way, I have no quarrel with what OEA is proposing. But where our amendments came from, the Dash 3s, Chuck and I were in a discussion, and he said we ought to, everybody believes we ought to have it. I mean, there's no quarrel there. Said we ought to phase it in, see if that would work. And so Dash 3 were developed by trying to address, one, getting rid of the tuition, two, phasing it in on terms of funding, not phasing it in when you start, leaving it optional. Three, not doing anything, continue the charging for tuition for now and then capping it, get rid of it, because most of us agree we shouldn't have it, and then have it implemented, start after the 2011 session so that if it's a disaster, you could change it in 2011. And that's a little spin off the proposal by Beth Ansett. We'll build a plan out of that. And so that, the plan may well include something similar as far as the phasing goes. But so I have no quarrel with what she's proposed or no tight authorship for what I proposed or we
dash
proposed.
Twos.
Yeah. No, ours were the dash threes. Are yours the twos?
No, I don't have amendments.
Yeah.
They're
not.
The twos are yours.
Yeah.
Chair.
Are the twos and the, well, I'll just wait. Go ahead. Chuck, do you have something to add?
Chuck Bennett, Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I really would just echo what Ozzie had to say. This is, his and mine are the Dash 3s, and it's an attempt to find a pathway to full-day kindergarten, really using a carrot. We think this is the kind of approach, but I have absolutely no quarrel with OEA's proposal. I think putting an idea like this one to the test and having a further discussion of it could only be helpful. Whether 1/8 is the right answer or this can be done in 2 years rather than 4 years, things like that I think are certainly ways to go. The main thing that we were concerned about is to continue the current system, including tuition. But in looking at the tuition issue, we were very concerned that whatever plan comes up, it caps that and begins to phase that out. The whole concept of people paying for education is troublesome and feel like that needs to be moved out of the way as rapidly as possible. So we would hope that be part of any, if there is an interim study, that would be part of the implementation charge, is how do we do that? How do we go through that process?
The best way to phase it in.
Sorry?
The best way to phase it in.
That's what we thought.
And phase out.
Phase out
the tuition.
Yeah, phase in public money, phase out private. Thank you.
Questions of the panel? Senator Metzger?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you all for working on this issue. I
and we'll just kind of take this potluck, whoever wants to respond. I'm not going to ask anyone in particular because you probably all have an opinion on it, but when I was looking at the Dash 2, is I guess one concern I'd have about the Dash 2 effort is on Section 6, it talks about the school district may request the Department of Education to calculate, provide an apportionment for, you know, it just sounds like, a real soft shell thing. It doesn't require they get any money. They can say, you can ask us, and we can come back and say, we can't do that or we won't do that. Can anybody give me a thought about, I just don't understand what that does, because we make lots of requests, Department of Education, usually the response is, well, give me some money, I can give it to you, but otherwise, no. So I just want to know what that does.
I don't know. I didn't write that. But to the issue, the reason that we put in it will be 1/8 is if you're going to get it done, you got to say we're going to get it done.
Well, that's
and if you wait until, we won't do it till you guys raise enough extra money. I've been around here a long time, and when you raise extra money, you kind of tend to take it from some. I mean, it's quite often we'll raise, say, school for this amount, but oh, by the way, X of it goes for kindergarten. So there's only so much money, so I don't care how you label it. And if you don't get extra money, if you wait till we get extra money to the extent that everybody's satisfied, you're waiting a long, long time. And
I could continue, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I guess that's my point, is that I appreciate what it does, but I don't think it changes anything. I mean, I'm just asking that question of those, is that if we're trying to advance the ball, we're saying you can request things, but there's no procedure for where the department would have to then allocate those forces. You're shaking your head. Do you want to comment on that? Am I wrong? Yeah. But it just kind of sounds kind of like frosting.
Well, Mr. Chair, in reading this, and I'll look forward to Beth Ann's analysis of it too, it does have the feel that a district that is offering full day would be able to request a full weight. Am I correct? Is that what you're getting to with them? I thought that was it. It was essentially, if I've gone there,
right,
and we're talking 61% are there with full day, I can go system of requesting, and presumably if I request, I get my full weight for this. So it would sort of piecemeal in districts that want to go in and ask for it. I can't imagine a district that wouldn't go in if they're asking a full day and ask for a full weight. If I understand the amendment, do I understand the amendment? Okay.
Well, yeah. I think I understand that, Mr. Chair, that can request it. I'm trying to say what's going to be the response.
I think it's a check in the mail. That'd be my impression. If you ask for it, you get it. I assume that's what you had.
The check's in the mail.
Well, then I would like to have that clear, that they will then receive it after if they meet whatever the requirements are of the request, that they will get that. I mean, if we're trying to move towards to implement this, then there, again, certainty would be if the department is going to establish the rules for making the request, then the department shall respond with the check in the mail if whatever the rules that are promulgated are correct. Is that, I see nods in the back of the room. I mean, that would seem to be a bit more certainty, because otherwise I like the Dash 3 amendment, which does provide a very certain incremental increase to get where we're going.
Mr. Chairman, we appreciate that you like the Dash 3 better. We think that is a way to move towards certainty in a more orderly fashion without disrupting the distribution of funds rapidly, and give districts a chance to adjust to this. We think there are a lot of districts that will quickly go toward full-day kindergarten. The incentive, you add that incentive, plus you kind of relieve that inequity of facility among the districts where they really do need a little time to do, whether it's to bring in the relocatable or build another classroom or revamp classrooms in an older building in the Dash 3s. And again, I think they work well with the OEA proposal. There may be things we've just overlooked that need to be included in any implementation plan, but this just lets districts essentially that are at full-day kindergarten come in and ask for a full-weight formula. I mean, it's not as clear, I think, as you would like, but I think it just says that. This I think our plan is a little more orderly than this plan.
Tricia, and Beth Ann, if you want to weigh in.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I believe that with the school improvement fund, correct me if I'm wrong about this, districts already can request school improvement funds for full-day kindergarten.
Right.
So they do already have the ability to go to the department and seek additional funding for full-day kindergarten. This just lets them have a different weight in the funding formula, which we would suggest is something that should be discussed in the interim.
Mr. Chair, can I ask one more? Because I think, Trish, you just got to the point that I'm concerned about. And you guys are all expert. Again, Beth Ann or Ozzie or Chuck, for all you represent, I'd like to see your opinion on this. You're just talking about incentives. When you mentioned the desk, it just provides incentives to kind of get where we want to go. And Trish, you just mentioned the school improvement fund, which is something I have expressed in this committee. I'm very concerned about, having chaired that committee. We started the school improvement fund, which is separate and distinct over the $6 billion that was requested for schools. We put that in, and we put a narrow thing that you could apply to. So therefore, we kind of said what policy would be if you wanted to go there.
Right.
We got a report that this was a great thing from the governor's office. We got a report that in the last year and a half, we've had a 25% increase in schools offering full-day kindergarten. So my question to you is, if we follow the general plan that the governor has, which is to get rid of the school improvement fund and just put it in the regular ADMW, and it's just a school budget and it's not tied to any particular outcome, do you believe that that extra 25% of schools who have moved to full-day kindergarten will continue to invest in that? Or do you think that we will see a drop-off because there's no longer a specific pot of money that is tied to that particular outcome?
Well,
or will they continue that, or will they, since it's now general fund money and they can use it for just general school operations, that we will not continue that advance and may actually see a retreat in students in full-day kindergarten programs?
Senator Hass, Senator Metzger, I this morning got a call from Klamath Falls City, and the superintendent asked if she could come up as soon as there's another hearing on this issue, if there's another hearing. I told her there was one this afternoon, but I'd be glad to reflect her comments, and it runs to your comment. They use their money, their school improvement money, to go to full-day kindergarten. Rousing success. Absolutely. She wouldn't go back on that now. She didn't care if you take her school improvement money and turn it into whatever you want to. She is keeping full-day kindergarten down there. It has been a major success. It's the one reason we really don't need to particularly study kindergarten. Everyone who gets it going loves it. And so do the parents. What's kind of ironic is I don't think you'd have anyone close a full-day kindergarten. You would see more probably go forward under the general budget required. The problem is we're going to end up closing schools in this state. That's the simple thing. We're going to close them all, for that matter, and we'll see how parents react to the general closure, because I can tell you how they'd react to the general closure of schools in the state will be very similar to how the parents of kindergartners would react if you closed their school. So we'll get to measure that kind of reaction. I just don't think you could close kindergartens at this point. I really don't.
Okay. If you remove the school improvement money specifically as it's aimed at kindergarten, I don't believe you'll lose any kindergartens. You obviously will slow down getting any more, because clearly it helped get some started. But I don't think there's a school administrator that could survive deciding that's the cut we ought to make. Is the kindergarten.
Okay, then if I could, just one more then.
Sure.
So just to your point then, what you're saying, Mr. Rhodes, is what we heard from the governor's office, that the school improvement segregation did help advance the people investing and exploring the benefits of full-day kindergarten in their district.
As much as the people I represent don't like it, that's true. I mean, whether it's kindergarten or something else, it made them think about how are we going to spend this money. Now, people were able to move it around to accomplish what they wanted, et cetera, but it focused the planning discussion on those things.
Thank you.
And I no longer speak for all of them, so Chuck, you want to say something different?
I certainly agree that it helped focus, but if you'll recall the guidelines on school improvement fund, that was a very broad set of guidelines, including adding full-day kindergarten. I think what you saw is a tremendous interest in this state in having full-day kindergarten. I don't think school improvement moved them toward it. I think there's just an interest, and they had some extra money, and one of the things you could do with it, besides everything else, it appeared in that. That was pretty broad definition. I just think there's a lot of interest, and there's a tremendous amount of pressure from parents of these younger children to get kindergarten going. I mean, these districts have real interest in having full-day kindergarten. I think it helps, but I'm not sure you can give it. I don't think you can assign it the level of importance in that decision that is paramount. I mean, I think there were a bunch of factors at work.
But the one nice thing about it is it was more carrot than stick.
Well, I like carrots.
That was the beauty
of it. We like carrots a lot. Yes, Mr. Chair, we like carrots. They're good for your eyes. But also, you know, it's not our experience that school districts do not want to add programs that will benefit students. They do. We spend more time worrying about the things we can't do than turning away things we could if we had that opportunity. I don't know if the legislature had given us $300 million extra dollars without ties, how many kindergarten programs we would have gotten out of that. I don't know the answer to that question. I believe, though, that the major impediment to full-day kindergarten is not an unwillingness to provide the program. It is an inability to provide it, given the funding that we have right now in schools.
Thank you. Well, on that note, too, Trish, it's the one thing about, you know, we always, I forgive me for being repetitive if I am, but it's not like we're not doing kindergarten now in all the school districts. It's
That's
just
correct.
That it's very expensive because
very
of the economies
expensive.
Of scale. 2.5 hours for all those teachers. Mr. Tarzan has to hire a specialist to come in for that small.
That's right.
You know, it's just not the most efficient way. And, you know, maybe it's these times that we're in that results in kind of a jujitsu that this is how we get to full day, because it is a more efficient expenditure, and if that's what the charge is, to do more with less and to find those kinds of economies. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I first want to compliment Senator Metzger on his excellent leading questions. He did a very good job with that. I won't be able to discuss the amendments in too much detail because the bulk of which I got when I arrived here today, but I did want to go back a little bit to the comment that was made about the requesting and whether that means the check is in the mail and the nodding heads, because I was looking a little bit too, and I think it kind of depends on whose heads are nodding, and I wouldn't want to be in a situation of relying on that, and I haven't had an opportunity to really compare the details in the amendments, but I like the certainty of the dash threes in that aspect, that I think that having some kind of certainty is important rather than sort of a discussion about what particular language means with regard to the request. So that's just a little bit of thought since we're on in work session, that I really haven't had a chance to be able to get into these two different approaches in enough depth at this point. But I certainly appreciate the comments that were made about the priority of a full-day kindergarten. And, you know, my concern is, again, like was expressed by the speakers on the panel, that if we wait until there's enough money for everything, we're going to be waiting for a very long period of time, unless somebody brought a working crystal ball and can tell us when things are going to change. So I think it is helpful to have some guidelines for implementation, but I frankly think we need a lot more information about the right steps to take and when that will be and the phase-in. But I would rather have the detail in the phase-in rather than the general terms.
Thank you. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe could clarify the cost and the numbers that you had recommended in Section 4. What is the cost?
On the twos?
On dash twos.
Dash twos.
Threes. Excuse me, dash three. Dash three.
Thinking, maybe
there's a solution, is that rather than dealing in numbers, actual dollar numbers, we do it in percentage of cost, and then you prorate it out over a long enough period of time so that the tuition that's charged gradually reduces down as a percent, and over time then you've integrated full-day kindergarten, but do it over a long enough period of time, and then the committee that would be formed would be focusing more on capacity and capital requirements, but we actually set in a schedule that would eventually migrate into. In my mind, I don't know what kind of costs we're talking about, and the tuition that's charged, does it cover a fraction, a portion, all?
Mr. Chair.
And then you've got various grades of supplemental, 0.6, 2.5, 0.75, 0.87, or 8.75, or...
By eighths.
Could you explain and maybe offer some comments?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, you could, I suspect, decide what it costs to add it. You'd run into, does it cost more in District X, District Y, because of facilities or a variety of things? Mm-hmm. All this did was take the way we distribute money now and 1/8 by this year will be $800 to $900, depending on what happens here. And so you'd add another $800, and the average tuition out there right now is about $2,500.
Yeah.
And so I took the $800 increase and took it off the tuition. It's not anything to do with cost. It's based on how we distribute the money at the present time. And a full kindergarten kid right now is the same value in terms of a weight as a full any other student. And the other issue is kindergarten kids also get the weights for second language, some of those things. So that gets built into this automatically. And the discussion you've been having about ones and whether that you would request it or not, I think your intent is that if you have full-day kindergarten, you get the money for that. And if that's so, I think you should just put it in the formula like we did in 3. If you run a full-day kindergarten, the kid counts as a full day. And because that's what, if you did the request route, in the end, either the state funds it out of the state school fund, which I assume they would, or they don't. And you might as well put it in there that it is a count, and then there's no, you have it, you get funded for it.
If I might follow up, how do you migrate then from where we are today to full day, fully funded?
Well, that's it. The ones don't do it in the same way that we proposed in the 3s. I think what the ones do is say if you're doing it right now, you get full, I don't know when it becomes effective. I haven't had a chance to read it very carefully.
2012.
13. Then you 13, migrate.
13, excuse me, yeah. 13.
I think you're migrating that. Those that offer it get supported, and those that don't get supported. And
right.
The only between that and the 3s is that those that do would get 1/8 support. Because one of the issues you'll have is that some districts will have and some won't. So those that get accounts, that reduces the money you put into those accounts reduces the value of an ADM weight overall. So if you don't add full-day kindergarten, you will lose money to those who do, and I don't know how much it is. I don't think over the planning that you could do in this situation, I think that's manageable. But again, the only way that I went about this was take the current distribution and try to connect it to getting rid of the tuition and create some progression in how much you spent or provided school districts. That's the only logic there is behind that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Cruz.
I am confused. And I'm not sure what your pleasure is at this point. I'm not overly thrilled with the glide path. I think that complicates the hell out of things. It may be the appropriate way to go. The thing I liked about the ones was there's a date certain in here. And my sense would be that schools would be ramped up to go at a date certain. And And as far as the twos, I did not see a date certain in the twos, which is, but what the twos have is the entity to do the work. Although I would say that I would modify section 3 because what this entity would be doing would not be to advise school districts and public charter schools, although ultimately they would. It would be to advise us as to what we need to do. And so I would want to change in that. I mean, clearly it needs to be inclusive, but what we want is an entity that's going to advise us as to how to proceed, I would think. So, you know, I'm not saying that a glide path maybe isn't the best way to go, but I like the concept of a date certain, and everybody will glide there themselves. So, because otherwise we're going to get into playing games with formula, and I'd just soon not play games with formula. You know, at a date certain, it's a full ABM for kindergarten, period. So, I mean, that's just my humble opinion.
Bruce, there is a date certain, though, in the section, in the dash twos.
Well, I didn't see it. Is it on the back? Oh, okay.
So,
Mr. Chair, just as a reminder, the OEA plan is not included in an amendment. A couple people have looked at me like that one of the amendments might belong to OEA. They've not. I think they incorporate some of the things that all of you have brought forward as important. We agree that a date certain makes a lot of sense. We think that all of the amendments that we've seen today and in the last hearing are evidence that there are a lot of different ways to do this and that it makes some sense to take a hard look and to figure out which works best in Oregon. We do want to move the ball forward, and a date certain is important to setting an appropriate goal, and we would ask that the outline enclosed in our testimony be drafted as an amendment for consideration.
Well, I think the dash twos represent that concept, too. I think we're in agreement in some ways. And, you know, until Senator Morris's comment, I didn't think that the twos and the threes were... I thought that they were incompatible.
Yeah.
But you raised a question that maybe they could be merged. You raised that issue. So maybe. So let's keep hammering away at this. And I do appreciate you all for wanting to move this forward. If there is one overlying theme that we heard in our hearing last week, it was that not only do we want to move forward, but we need to lock in a date. So
yeah.
That's, I think, the goal here.
I think if I may, Mr. Chair, and I think that the important part is, you know, right now kindergarten isn't even a half a day, and yet that's what we call it. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes. It's less than most preschool programs. And I think that what you hear are educators and parents both recognizing that kindergartners need at least a half day, probably more. There may be something in between. I don't know. But 2 hours and 40 minutes is not very much time when you are a squirmy wormy trying to learn how to read and play nicely with the other kids. So,
spoken like a parent who
yep.
may have had some experience recently.
Yep. And that was with my parent hat on for sure.
Mr. Chair, I think the one thing we can put to bed at this point in time, it's not the goal. The goal is no longer debatable. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's quit debating the goal. Let's just figure out how to get there.
Yeah. Hey. Mr. Chairman, I do, Senator Cruz, want to point out in the dash threes we have a whole series of date certains. That actually move us toward this thing getting done. So I hope you'll take a look at that.
Okay.
I'd like to comment on Beth Ann's on you can't get enough done in 2 hours and 40 minutes with a classroom full of 20 kids. If that concept isn't understood by you folks really well, I've got a set of triplets that are 5 years old. I'll loan them to you for 24 hours, and you try to get all of them doing anything the same way.
Well, thank you all for being here and for being patient on this. Thank you, committee. Committee, I know we have, it's moving late today, but we do have time to do one of these two bills. So I'm going to close a hearing and work session on Senate Bill 44 and open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 65.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to do a brief summary of this bill?
Please.
As a shorthand, I think committee members in the Department of Education refer to this as the Vernonia bill, and it basically allows some flexibility in statutes that require districts to meet certain filing dates in order to receive state school funds, and for the Department of Education, similarly, to provide funding regardless of emergency conditions. That is the gist of it, Senator Haas. We do have fiscal and revenue statements before us as well.
Okay. And we have the Department of Education testifying, Morgan Allen.
Yeah, I'm wondering why Morgan didn't come up and testify on the last bill.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, I'll save my thoughts on that for another day and time. But on, no pun intended, Mr. Chair, on to less weighty issues.
Not bad.
Senate Bill 65. So, yes, as Ms. Richardson pointed out, this bill sort of came about because of the Vernonia situation, and fortunately none of the scenarios that this bill is hoping to avoid happened, but it sort of got our folks thinking in our finance office. So, again, for the record, Morgan Allen, Legislative Director for the Department of Education, and essentially what Senate Bill 65 does is it would allow the Superintendent of Public Instruction, pursuant to rules created by the State Board of Education, to waive or extend some of the dates related to school finance reporting and state school fund payments in case of some sort of human-related disaster or natural disaster, which would either prevent a school district from giving us a required report or information, or conversely, you know, if we had a fire at the Department of Education and our building burnt down, it would allow the superintendent to put our contingency plans that we have in place to deal with those situations and extend dates for getting money to districts and things like that. So there's the bill amends several statutes related to these types of reports. And again, currently, the department or the superintendent does not have any authority to waive or extend those dates. And in the most egregious examples, we would have to withhold state school fund. So even if a school district experienced a natural disaster or some sort of other horrendous event that, for example, I gave two examples in my testimony. If a school district audit report, which is due December 31st of every year, was delayed because there was some sort of natural disaster, our answer to the district, tough. The statute says we have to start withholding your state school fund payments in January. There's no flexibility there. Another example is if a district is not standard, for example, they have some sort of natural disaster or emergency and they fall below the required instructional hours, by law, you know, within 90 days they have to give us a report sort of explaining what happened and what they're going to do to remedy that. Well, if they don't have a school district, they don't have buildings, or their kids are scattered about other districts, you know, we have to say, tough, you still have to get us that information in 90 days. So what we're really trying to do with Senate Bill 65 is allow for some reasonable accommodation. Again, the State Board of Education would develop rules that would give the superintendent the flexibility about in regards to these timelines that are imposed on districts in the event of disaster. Right now, again, in some cases, we don't have any choice but to withhold state school fund payments, and the superintendent and our finance staff believe that really could only make a bad situation worse in a lot of instances. So I would be happy to answer any questions you might have, or to answer any questions, because it is the bill contains a lot of formula stuff. There's things in there that I could explain. But essentially, the gist of it is if there's a natural disaster, the department could extend the timeline where we make payments to districts, or conversely, if a district experienced a natural disaster, they could, the superintendent could say, we understand your situation, you don't have to get us that audit report right now, we're going to continue to give you your state school fund payments. So that's what we're trying to address with this bill. It's sort of a preventative bill.
Do we need to have any parameters around the rules that are drawn up over this? I ask because I am kind of a stickler on people who fail to make deadlines or fail to make provide the paperwork, and I wouldn't want this to be too loosey-goosey to allow for, you know, failures when even in emergencies when you know, they should be through.
Well, Mr. Chair, I can assure you we have the good fortune of having Cindy Hunt at the agency right now, and she's in charge of rulemaking, so she would actually be drafting the rules around this to share with the State Board of Education, and it would be our intention to give some reasonable flexibility, but not indefinite timelines. You know, once a district had a chance to get itself back up on its feet. And again, as I said, this has never happened before, at least my understanding from our folks. It's never really happened before, even in the case of Vernonia. That happened in the fall, right around the time some of these reports were due. We didn't get into any ugly situations that we had to withhold state school fund, but it's just sort of one more tool in the toolbox in case those types of things happen.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah. Are we talking about declared disasters, or who makes the determination that it hits the category of disaster?
Chair Hass and Senator Cruz, that is not defined in the bill. The State Board of Education would be required to develop rules that would lay out what would be defined as a disaster.
Was the Vernonia flood?
I believe that was a state and a federal disaster, I believe, Senator Hass.
Yeah, Mr. I'm just wondering if, I mean, the governor has the ability to declare disaster both statewide and locally, and so I'm just wondering if there's a connection here on that. I mean, you know, it can't be an arbitrary sort of thing. You got to have some things that trigger it,
I think it would be very, very difficult to draw specific parameters around the declaration of what's human caused or what's natural caused disasters. In my judgment, you'd almost have to put the faith in the superintendent to make the right call given the circumstances. I don't know how it would work.
I'm not trying to be difficult, but for example, when Glide burnt, and if a separate section of that school had burnt, they could have lost all records, lost all everything. I'm assuming that would qualify. So, you know, so really, there are. You may not have had it, but you could.
Well, and Chair Hass and Senator Cruz, really our intention in this bill is really sort of the horrible Vernonia-type disaster, a natural event, but we very easily could see a situation where a central office burned down in a school district or a computer system crashed, and it might take several weeks or months or to get those records restored, or they may just not be restored.
Right.
Similarly, you know, the audit reports, if the CPA firm went under or their building burnt down and all the records of the audit report that are due to us were lost in a fire or some sort of disaster, that wouldn't be the school district's fault. It may not have even happened in the school district. It could have happened, you know, somewhere else. So I will say, Mr. Chair, you're putting some faith in the State Board of Education and the superintendent that they could make some judgments about what sort of situations would be allowable and things like that. So.
Well, that's why they get the big bucks, so that's okay.
I think you're right.
You ready to roll, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, I think so.
Mr. Chair?
I think we're in a work session.
Cool.
Oh, we are?
We're in a work session.
Yes, we are.
Okay. All right. Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 65 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair Morris, move 65. Senate Bill 65 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there objections to Senate Bill 65? Seeing none, the measure passes with the due pass recommendation. I think we've gone through the committee. I'll carry it. And since that was so short, we'll open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 63.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 63 repeals the statute permitting school districts with child development specialist programs to seek reimbursement for associated costs. It declares an emergency and takes effect upon passage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and this one is even simpler than 65. This is really a technical cleanup bill that would remove an obsolete provision from statute related to payments to school districts that still have child development specialist programs. This is another one of the great benefits of having Cindy Hunt is we're trying to clean up our rules and statutes as we go along as well. So just to give you a little bit of background, child development specialist programs were created by the legislature in the early 70s and 1973, and they were created because apparently at the time, I was just a wee babe, but there was a shortage of school counselors, and child development specialists essentially for all intents and purposes do a lot of work that's similar in nature to that of a school counselor. And many years ago, the legislature apparently used to provide funds to the Department of Education that then we would provide grants to school districts to help pay for their child development specialist programs. So talking to our staff, our records show that the last school district that received one of these grants was the Ashland School District in the 1991-1992 school year. Further, in the 99 legislative session, the legislature basically said you can't have child development specialists in high schools anymore, so you need to have counselors or other folks. So there are now fewer than 200 child development specialists throughout the state, scattered in a few districts. And what Senate Bill 63 does, it repeals ORS 329-265, which is that statute that requires the superintendent of the Department of Education to reimburse school districts for their programs. Again, there have been no funds requested in the last 17 years, and none of our staff members can remember a school district asking for any of these funds, and the legislature hasn't appropriated any for quite some time. So we actually have, just so you know, we have a statewide Child Development Specialist Advisory Committee that gives it, you know, shares thoughts about these programs with the Department of Education, and according to our folks, they are supportive of this proposal. So it won't create a fiscal impact on the agency or school districts, and it won't disrupt these child development specialist programs. It's really cleaning up an obsolete provision in statute. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, we love repealing laws once in a while.
Well, I sent out a press release.
I hate to see such
be eliminated a law yeah. today.
Well, yeah. I hate to see such a viable program go away. You know, it's just
that is man bites dog news. Yes.
Just a quick question, Mr.
Sure.
Chair.
Senator
Morgan, I'm just a little curious about the. You said there's fewer than 200 child development specialists working in Oregon schools. Are they just part of the district's budget then? And maybe the districts don't know that they can ask for reimbursement, or they would have to.
Well, actually, that is a good question. Chair Hass and Senator Bonamici, my understanding is that it's an optional thing for school districts to have in addition to still have, as part of their comprehensive sort of school guidance counseling program, it's optional that the K through 8 schools can still have child development specialists. And as far as requests, again, you know, I check with our staff and nobody has asked for this money for a long time, and I don't think we've gotten any money in even a longer amount of time. Maybe I'm sneaking one under the radar, but I certainly don't. I certainly hope not, but
you're doing so well.
You caught me.
Mr. Chair, it would make sense that if there's no money there, people wouldn't ask for it.
Yeah.
But right. And it looks
that
like
doesn't happen around here.
Mr. Chair, it does look like there was some discretion because it says if the superintendent approves the application for reimbursement, but I don't know if there were any guidelines on when.
And just further, the guidelines were, I believe, that we could reimburse up to 75% of the cost of the program.
Like two
so the actual amendment being repealed is not in the bill.
Okay,
yeah, but we do, Senator Bonamici, we do, school districts that want to have child development specialists have to get approval from the Department of Education to have those folks in there, so we sort of review that. I could offline tell you, give you some information on that if you're interested. So.
Thank you.
Committee, we're in work session.
Good.
Ready to go.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 63 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morse moves Senate Bill 63 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, any objections to passing this bill to the floor with a due pass? Seeing none, motion passes. And Senator Cruz, would you like to carry this bill?
You betcha.
That is all on our agenda. We are adjourned.
All right.